This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson, here for Terry Gross, who's on holiday. Psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton's books have explored issues of life and death in concentration camps, mass killings, and mind control. He's written about Nazi doctors, the survivors of Hiroshima, Vietnam veterans, and brainwashing in China. Lifton has said he hopes to draw meaning from the grotesque and unique enormity of evil. Lifton was an early member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a group opposed to the nuclear arms buildup. He's credited with coining the term psychic numbing to describe the way people avoid dealing with overwhelming threats, such as the possibility of nuclear war. Lifton is a professor of psychiatry at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and at the City University of New York. He's just revised his book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, a study of brainwashing in China, which he wrote in 1961. I asked him why he wanted to revise it after 29 years.
The first thing to say, of course, is that any author likes his books to stay in print. But the truth is that thought reform or thought reform-related issues just don't go away. I didn't write the book as an interpretation of the Chinese just at that moment, but rather an interpretation of a whole process, a whole phenomenon, which all too many others were capable of embracing. So I meant it to hold for other things, and now it has particular relevance, I think, in two ways. One is the whole cult phenomenon. Lots of people from cults have come to me in connection with this thought reform work. And the other, of course, has to do with China now and the democracy movement and the government's attempt to reinstate thought reform and a thought reform-dominated atmosphere.
I was curious to learn in reading your book that brainwashing is, in fact, a term directly translated from the Chinese.
Yes, right. But the term was originally translated from the Chinese, but from some kind of commentary, some sort of popular commentary. Really, the term the Chinese use is thought reform or ideological remolding. And I discourage the use of the word brainwashing because it doesn't quite mean anything specifically. On the other hand, it captures something, and it's a word that people use widely in English, and it just won't go away.
At what point in China did people stop believing the thought reform? I mean, we've seen radical changes going on in attitudes in China in the past year. At what point does a people no longer make themselves susceptible to thought reform?
One can't really designate a particular point, I don't think. But, you know, even when I did the study back in the mid-50s, it's hardly believable that it was so long ago, I sensed and wrote in my book that the Chinese had over-reformed their population, even from their own self-interest. That is, the government had come in on a wave of glory and had great popularity and energy in applying a thought reform program, but they applied it to a point beyond its usefulness, and a certain number of people were turned off by the exaggerated ideological pressure and the closing of the environment. But sometime much later on, perhaps during the late 60s and early 70s, there really occurred a major change. At that time, of course, the Cultural Revolution was in high gear, and a lot of people were very hurt by the Cultural Revolution, and the thought reform-like methods that were used then were more crude. And in the process, there was a lot of developing skepticism toward ideological programs and certainly thought reform in general. And what one heard or began to hear in the late 70s and early 80s were that they still had these programs, but that people didn't really take them so seriously. They were very casual about it, used them for socializing or for just discussing certain things that concerned them, and the programs didn't have the tautness and power that they had originally.
What would be an example of one of these programs today?
Well, what happened after the democracy movement and the really tragic denouement, really vicious denouement on the part of the regime, was that the regime announced very pointedly that it was going to reinstitute very active ideological remolding because that's what people needed. So what is taking place now is a kind of re-energizing of the thought reform program, largely at universities, but probably in most places where people work, and in the various small groups that exist throughout the Chinese population. It's hard to say how energetically they're being pursued because one gets a lot of signals, some of them direct, some of them indirect, and they're what one would expect, namely that people don't believe in the ideological remolding, they don't believe in the claims of the regime, and they don't take seriously the thought reform program.
One can't help but think of parallels of what's going on in Eastern Europe now. With some of the ideas of throwing
what's going
over.
On in Eastern Europe is very much interrelated in a way that the Chinese regime doesn't want to recognize. For one thing, it's very likely that the events in Eastern Europe were influenced by the democracy movement in China occurring earlier, and now the events in Eastern Europe have had an enormous impact on the Chinese people. And what this tells us, which is very important in terms of evaluating a process like this, is that there is a new phase of world communication. It is no longer possible to isolate a country or a segment of a country in anything like an absolute way.
Well, in fact, part of thought reform, whether it's in a cult or in a political society, depends on isolation. Do you think that thought reform is possible any longer?
Well, it's still possible. You can still try, and it may even have some effectiveness with some people, but it's bound to be considerably less effective for most people. The really principal requirement for thought reform is what I call milieu control, and that simply means the control of communication within an environment. You have to set up a controlling system of communication in order to carry through all the psychological pressures of thought reform. And when that control is very intense, as it could be in thought reform environments in the 50s and during the time that I studied it, then people feel in some way frightened to speak against the going assumptions. And in some degree, the requirements or the position of the environment becomes internalized quickly so that the control becomes self-imposed, a kind of internal control on the part of the environment, setting up what has been called a God's eye view. And unless you have that degree of control, you simply can't have as effective a thought reform program.
My guest is psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. He's just revised his 1961 book on brainwashing in China. It's called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. The religious people seem to hold out most against thought reform, those who had a very established worldview. In particular, in your study, you cite Catholics who held out longest against the thought reform.
Yes, but it's not so simple, as I also tried to suggest. It's true that one could resist much better if one had a strong sense of inner identity, which in turn requires an attachment to some larger set of convictions, and this was certainly true of a number of Catholic priests. On the other hand, there were a tiny number of Catholic priests, one in particular whom I described as having undergone a near conversion to Chinese communist thought reform because he had a proclivity, a tendency toward what I call ideological totalism, toward all or none belief systems that was psychologically part of his makeup. And as he said to me, I tend to like to give a blank check toward what I believe in or toward what I'm part of. And he gave that first to the Catholic Church, and then under the pressure and attraction of the Chinese Communist Thought Reform Program, he came to give it to the Chinese Communists. So that situation applies too. The larger principle is that a strong sense of inner identity, belief system, and attachment to alternative principles, all that helps in resisting thought reform.
You're interested in the ideas and strengths of identity. When somebody signs up, gives themselves a blank check for a cult, be it following the Bhagwan or a Jim Jones, what is going on in that dynamic?
Well, identity is very much an issue. But to that, I would add an emphasis that I mentioned then, but would give much more stress to now, and that is the life-death situation and the life-death symbolism within which I've been working more in recent years. So to answer your question, a young person who joins a cult may be subjected to thought reform-like pressures, but whatever the circumstances under which he himself experiences a form of self-surrender, if that happens, he then makes an all-or-none commitment to the cult. He forms, in effect, a second self. It's what I have come to call doubling. And something in his life-death parameter, in his psychological economy, has opted for a total commitment to that alternative belief system as a way of living in the world or surviving in the world.
Have you been called in to work as a deprogrammer with people who've been freed from cults?
No, I wouldn't take on that kind of role. What has happened in my work is that people who have been troubled by cult behavior, often the parents of young people caught up in cults or subjected to thought reform-like procedures by cults, have contacted me and consulted with me in connection with this totalistic phenomenon. And indeed, some cults read up on it also because they wanted to claim that they weren't using thought reform or these procedures. But in that way, I was brought into the whole cult issue, and I'm very critical of any sort of group that takes on or takes over a person's psyche to the extent that one no longer is autonomous or thinks freely, so I'm not happy about cult behavior. But as a psychiatrist interested in the phenomenon, working with a young person rather than as either a deprogrammer or as working for any other group.
What have you found in talking with some of these young people? Is there a common thread that you've noticed?
Well, yes, there are common threads, and first, in connection with some of the cult programs, and one has to really identify the particular cult at a particular time in terms of what they're doing in a particular program. But in many cases, there has been a program with very strong parallels to thought reform. What? Now, sometimes there are very poignant moments with these young people because there is a moral question here, too. I can remember one young person who was brought to me, and I was struck by a kind of conflict in him and a conflict that he evoked in others because he had come from a cult under some duress from his parents. But he also said that the cult made him rather happy because everything was taken care of. He was with a group. He felt very close to people. He didn't have to worry about making any personal arrangements. And his life seemed secure and laid out for him. And I had to ask myself, what is my moral responsibility in a situation like this? And I saw it as, now I didn't like what he had become and I didn't like what the cult was doing, but I saw my responsibility as talking to him and helping him to see what was happening and helping him to be in a position to make his own decision. Unfortunately, he never did reach such a psychological position because something happened between him and his parents, some antagonism, and he fled from his parents, went back to the cult. But ironically, I was told that he was last seen at a bus stop on his way back to the cult, holding my book, still struggling with the issue. In any case, that's the kind of poignant moral and psychological situation that can arise.
Many of your books have dealt with extremely uncomfortable topics, the way that doctors behaved in concentration camps, going into great detail about their form of practice, the survivors of Hiroshima. You've also talked about the idea of psychic numbing, and I wonder if there's some sort of doubling that goes on with you to help you cope with some of the very raw and brutal material you deal with as a writer.
Well, often people have asked me, how am I able to cope with or constantly immerse myself in a number of rather grotesque subjects, perhaps the work on Nazi doctors, the most grotesque of all. And this is a rather delicate matter. There's no single answer. One answer I quickly give is that I draw comical, amusing bird cartoons. I'm an amateur, or not-so-amateur, bird cartoonist. I've actually published 2 books of bird cartoons. There's a certain truth to that. One needs alternative outlets. But still, there is a personal struggle in my work. One does what one feels one can do, and one knows how to do. And through a series of steps, I've taken on this kind of issue, and it feels right for me. I learned something very important about my own reactions during the very early stages of my work in Hiroshima. And this was back in 1962 when I was interviewing survivors of that first tragic use of an atomic weapon on a human population. And when I went about Hiroshima talking to people about doing the study, it wasn't so difficult, and they were helpful to me, and I made preparations to do the study. But when I began my systematic, individual, depth psychological interviews, that was another matter, because now I was hearing in great detail some of the really painful, grotesque experiences that survivors had undergone. And I was temporarily there alone. My wife and then infant son hadn't yet moved to Hiroshima from Kyoto, where we had been living, or I was involved in a different study. And I was staying in a small inn while waiting for my family to arrive and beginning the interviews of the study. And I became extremely anxious. In the first few nights, I had difficulty sleeping. I had nightmares. And I really began to wonder whether I would be able to do the study. I knew it was a very important one, but I wondered whether I would be able to see it through. But within a few days, I found that rather quickly, that anxiety diminished. And I found myself much calmer and quite able to take in what was being said to me. Of course, I felt the pain that they expressed, but I was able to look at it in a way that I could ask myself what it represented and think through some of the patterns as a professional who was doing a study of the effects of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. And, of course, I went on and spent 6 months in Hiroshima and did the study. And later on, of course, I thought about this, and I came to see this as what I called selective professional numbing. That is, I had to have a certain degree of detachment from the raw pain of the work in order to be able to do any study at all. On the other hand, I had to retain sufficient sensitivity to the pain of the people I was talking to in order to do a useful and compassionate study. That balance is always a struggle, and it's never perfectly achieved, but that's what one has to strive for. And then, of course, I thought about the whole idea of psychic numbing, because that was very prominent in the people I was interviewing, where it served temporarily as a defense mechanism that they required in order to remain sane. And I thought a lot about psychic numbing in various perpetrators of extreme situations or of massive violence or potential perpetrators, such as the those who make or project the use of nuclear weapons.
My guest is psychiatrist, writer, and teacher Robert J. Lifton. You seem startled that in 1962 nobody had thought about doing a psychological study of the victims of the atomic bombings in Japan.
I was startled by it, and I soon came to a principle, namely that the more important a study is, the less likely people are to do it. I think that a really important study, especially when it's threatening, and it's likely to be when it raises threatening issues, is likely to create pain that the investigator, no less than anybody else, wants to resist. But the second reason might be even more important. Scholars and investigators, thinkers in general, make certain presuppositions or impose certain issues of method or approaches to problems which they don't like to change. And a really fundamental problem or event requires one to question those methods and those assumptions.
There are risks that go along with this. Bruno Bettelheim, for instance, found that in your study on the Nazi doctors, by providing too much understanding, you can run the risk of forgiving people for a particular, you know, heinous act.
Well, there is the risk of that. That is, one can run the risk of replacing moral judgment with a claim of something like clinical insight. Actually, though, I confronted that risk in really embarking on the study and made it very clear that I was holding a moral as well as a psychological perspective, and I use the word evil very centrally in my study. So I felt that having this model that included an ethical and moral judgment, combine it with a psychological one, that simply wasn't true of my study. But certainly that is a risk, and there are others as well.
Do you write with a sense of hope?
I have an enormous sense of hope. My whole body of work is predicated on the idea that by confronting these issues, the human imagination is capable of moving beyond them into more desirable ways. And much that has happened has given, I think, all of us great hope. Hope is not the same as a calculation of optimism or pessimism. Rather, it means that there are possibilities for good things happening in the world and to people, to better ways of behaving. And I think that's where hope lies.
Robert J. Lifton, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
Robert J. Lifton is a professor of psychiatry at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and at City University of New York. His books include Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, The Nazi Doctors, Indefensible Weapons, and Home from the War. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.